Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Awareness and Observation, Clear Light, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Devo Maheshwara, Guru Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Shri. Tomorrow starts chapter 6 in Merging with Shiva, Wisdom's Path. To the awakened mystic, there is only one mind. There is no your mind and my mind, just one mind finished, completed in all stages of manifestation. Man's individual awareness flows through the mind as the traveler treads the globe. Just as the free citizen moves from city to city and country to country, awareness moves through the multitude of forms in the mind. Well, that's an interesting concept to ponder. Just one mind, finished, completed in all stages of manifestation. So we don't usually look at it like that. When it comes to the mind, the various states of consciousness that we experience, we tend to see one state evolving or changing into another. We don't tend to see it this way, where all states of consciousness always exist. We also tend to think of it as we create the state of consciousness. And before we get into the sense of striving, you know, we're sitting in meditation, striving real hard, in the sense that we have to create this deep state of consciousness. If we strive hard enough, we're bound to create it. But it already exists. That's the point. All states of consciousness always exist, so we don't have to create anything by an effort of the will. In fact, an effort of the will can obscure a subtle state of consciousness. The mere idea of striving hard is a certain motion in the mind which can cover up something that's subtle. So, taking this idea, it's already there, we just have to find it. Don't have to create it. All states of consciousness are already there, we just have to find it, or relax into it, or figure out how to get from one place to another, and there it is. There is no your mind in my mind. So we also tend to do that. We see people and we label them. I like this person, I don't like that person. This person is this way, that person is that way. We're not really seeing things accurately. There's just the mind, and we can all experience whatever part of it we choose to, or life chooses for us, if we don't make our own choices. But clearly it's just the mind, so one person's mind isn't different than another person's mind. And someone that's by a guru can understand things clearly, because there's only one mind. It's like watching children grow up. You know, they're not all different. There's a certain similarity there. When you're 6 years old, you do things one way. When you're 12 years old, you're quite different. Why? Because there's only one mind. There's one pattern, and everyone follows along in a similar way to a large degree, particularly in growing up, where we get more differentiation is after we're grown up and what we do at that point. But the process of growing up shows very nicely the different ages and what kids naturally do at different ages, how there's just one mind. There's not your mind and my mind. Before we meditate, review the cycles of our life and erroneously conclude that the mind changes, that it evolves. Review joy one moment and despair the next. And because we feel so different in these states, assume we have changed. We grow up and look back on our childhood and again see the appearance of change. Through meditation, however, we observe that we have not changed at all. Awareness becomes our real identity, and it is pure and changeless. It was the same at 7 years of age as it is today. It is the same in happiness as it is in sadness. Pure awareness cannot change. It is simply aware. Therefore, you are right now the totality of yourself. You never were different, and you never will be. You are perfect at this very moment. Change is only a seeming concept created through false identification with the experiences we have in various areas of the one mind. So that's an interesting meditation, the idea of finding that which hasn't changed. But we were talking about growing up, so what is it that was the same in us at 6 years of age, 12 years of age, 18 years of age, and where we are today? It's our awareness. It hasn't changed. So finding that which is the same is an interesting meditation. So there's a famous meditation, Ramana Maharishi's Who Am I meditation. So an interesting, which it relates to this. Normally you say, I am this and I am that. I am 6 years old, I am 12 years old, I am happy, I am sad. I am here in Kauai, I am somewhere else. You always add something after I am, right? But if you can go, I am, and don't keep going, instead of I am here, just say I am, and you're looking at awareness. So that's one answer to the question, who am I? We're awareness, we're the experiencer, we're not what we experience, and we don't change, which is the idea here. We only think we change because of the false identification with the experiences we have in various areas of the one mind. Everything in the world and everything in the mind is as it should be, in a perfect state of evolution. Superconsciously, we can clearly see this through the eyes of our soul. When looking at it through the instinctive intellectual mind, we don't see this perfection. It is as if we have blinders on both sides of our eyes, like a donkey. The carrot of desire dangles right in front of our nose when we are in the instinctive intellectual mind, and we are going after it, step at a time, with our blinders on. We have to go in and in and in and reach an expanded state of awareness and gain the mountaintop consciousness where we perceive there is no injustice in the world. There is not one wrong thing. All is in perfect order and rhythm in Shiva's cosmic dance. So we talked about that a few weeks ago, that idea that everything is perfect. So a lot of our frustrations in life come because we're not able to accept conditions as they are. We want them to be different. Usually we want other people to be different, right? Because we're always just fine. We're the ones that are messed up. We want other people to be different. We want them to relate to us differently. And because of that, we're frustrated. And the frustration is a disturbance in the mind. The opposite of this point of view, which is the ability to accept people and conditions as they are, doesn't mean we don't want to make them better, but it means we're not frustrated by the way they are. The way they are makes sense to us. Okay, this is the way it should be. It shouldn't be different. Particularly when difficulties come our way, it can be hard to accept that this is the way it should be. It's easier when good fortune comes our way, right? Open the mail and there's a big check somehow. A bonus from work. Oh, this is great. But, you know, get a big bill in the mail. Whoops. Hard to think that things are perfect. But either way, they are. And everything is the way it is because of what's been set in motion in the past. Our big opportunity is in how we create the future by how we live in the present. Ability to impact the present is there, but it's much more limited and it's harder. But the ability to create the future, we have total flexibility there. We create the future how we want to, by how we live in the present. Should we acquire the ability to identify as the experiencer instead of the experienced, the true and valid nature of awareness and its patterns of movement in the mind become evident. We see the mind as a total manifestation containing all of the past and future evolutions in the eternal now. The mind is vast in its combinations of time, space, and form, contains every vibration from subtle to gross. Awareness is free to travel in the mind according to our knowledge, our discipline, and our ability to detach from the objects of awareness and see ourselves as the experience of awareness itself. Thank you. This explains many of the so-called mysteries of life. So that expands our concept even more. So everything that will be in the future has to exist in the present, in the mind. The computer that will be designed and created 20 years from now has to already exist. So they're the same. Nothing doesn't exist. It's just found in the mind. You have to go to the place in the mind where it already exists. That's what Buddha is saying. We see the mind as a total manifestation containing all of the past and future evolutions in the eternal realm. So some people, that's how they can predict the future. They just go to where the future is. And they're not that distinct from the present. To them, they have the ability to go and look at something in the future. Well, it exists in the mind. There are people with the ability to look back into the past and ahead to the future accurately and in detail. That feat is understood clearly in the light of awareness traveling through the mind. Sounds like I'm just explaining this. Entire mind exists right now, past and future included. These psychically talented individuals have trained their awareness to flow into areas of the mind that are unavailable to the average person. They go into the mind itself to view these phenomena. Similarly, ESP, mind reading, and other mystical wonders are illumined by the knowledge that there is only one mind and all phases of it are open to the spiritually awakened person. And we just commented on that. Sometimes you do that, you know what's coming up. So. Simply. Observation is the first faculty to appear in the awakening of the superconscious regions. Observation, when perceptively performed, is cultivated by abstinence from excessive talk. Talk dissipates the energies of the aura and of the vital body of man. A mystic generally does not talk very much, for his intuition works through reason. It does not use the processes of reason. Any intuitive breakthrough will be quite reasonable, but it does not use the processes of reason. Reason takes time. Superconsciousness acts in the now. All superconscious knowing comes in a flash out of the nowhere. Intuition is more direct than reason and far more accurate. Therefore, the mystic does not ask many questions or enter into lengthy conversations. So this is an important point, observation, and a good way of judging your observation is to go walking with a child, say a child would be, you know, 7 to 10 years old, you would know better than I, but before the intellect really turns on a lot in the child. Child is extremely observant and will point out things, you know, what's this, what's that, that you don't even see. And how can that be? You know, the child's more observant than you are. Shouldn't you be more observant than the child? No. Isn't this an ability which improves with age? You would think so, right? You can outreason the child. But you can't, usually we don't out-observe a child. Why is that? Well, it's because we have thoughts going on in our head. We're thinking more than children are. And so that thought, part of our awareness, goes into our thoughts. We're not seeing with 100% of our faculties. We're seeing with maybe 50% of our faculties, and 50% are wrapped up in our thoughts to some degree. Because a child isn't thinking, hasn't turned that on yet very much, and so 100% of awareness is in observation. So it's a very interesting practice to judge your observance. So what is the key? Well, the key is not to think unnecessarily. We don't want the mind going all the time. And one of the ways of harnessing that is by harnessing our speech. Speech is more evident than thinking. So therefore it's easier to harness our speech. And so the key word here is excessive talk. Abstinence from excessive talk, not abstinence from talk. So abstinence from talk is okay, but you know, on special occasions. But social conversation is part of life. And otherwise, it creates tension. You don't say anything, don't say enough. You know, it creates a tension. So excessive talk is just rambling on unnecessarily about frivolous things. It's, as Guru points out, it dissipates our energy. The energy could go higher into more creative thinking or into intuition. If we excessively talk, but we're using it at a fairly mundane level. We're using up a lot of energy. And if we talk excessively, it also means we think excessively. So likewise, if we back up on excessive talk, we back up on excessive thinking, and we become more observant, or our mind becomes quieter. So that's the important thing. Because we need to be observant to experience intuition. Intuition is there. But there's too much distraction, there's too much noise going on in our head, usually to identify it. So, it's like a radio that's always on, but it's turned very low. So to hear it, when you have, oh, I have to get rid of all the other noise, right? Say, oh, there it is. Oh, I like that sound. I like that song. I'm trying to hear it when all the other noise goes away. So that's like intuition. It's on, but it's quiet and easily covered up by the other noise that's going on inside of us. So therefore we need to quiet down enough to hear it, and then it's there. Ponder over this and apply it to yourself. Well, there's one more point here. Therefore, the mystic does not ask many questions or enter into lengthy conversations. Why is that? Well, the mystic is trying to get a deeper answer than reason would give, trying to understand something in a profound way. So if you throw it out into reason, you can stop the process. In other words, if you want an answer to something and you ask someone and they give it to you, you've stopped the process, right? You're not going to keep thinking about it normally, unless you don't like the answer. Normally you say, well, that sounds reasonable. But if you want the most profound answer on a mystical subject, you have to get it from your own intuition. So that's what this is saying. You're asking yourself the question, and therefore you don't end up in a lot of lengthy conversations. You're asking yourself the question and trying to find the answer in meditation, which can take a while. Because for most people, intuition is delayed. It's not instantaneous. You ask a question, you don't instantaneously get the answer. Most people don't. You ask the question, you might get the answer in a few days or in a few hours. Throw the question in the subconscious, let it bounce around a while, and the answer can come. Gurudeva calls that superconscious. Superconscious working through the subconscious is not immediate. Superconscious is immediate. You ask a question, you get an answer. Sub-superconscious, there's a time delay. Well, sometimes the same principle we were looking at before relates to what we're trying to are. The answer is right there in front of us, but we're trying too hard. So this kind of practice works well on something that's black and white, something that's right or wrong, such as mathematics or logic or something. You're trying to solve a problem and you can't solve it. You go away, come back in 15 minutes, and the answer is self-evident. Well, what was going on? Well, you were trying too hard. The mere act of trying was blocking the answer from coming. So that can happen. So sometimes the best way to find an answer is to take a walk or something, come back, try again, regroup. So we're not taught that, though. So you just push ahead. You use our willpower, we can solve this. But if the willpower doesn't work, then take a break and relax, and maybe the answer will come to you afterwards. So that's sub-superconscious.
Good morning, everyone. Our daily lesson from Gurudeva in the Master Course, the Merging with Shiva chapter, is currently chapter 8, Clear White Light, which is certainly a very mystical and powerful chapter. So I thought I'd read from it and make a few comments. Occasionally, young aspirants burst into inner experience indicating a balance of intense light at a still higher rate of vibration of here and now awareness than their almost daily experience of a moon glow inner light. The dynamic vision of seeing the head and at times the body filled with a brilliant clear white light, period. When this intensity can be attained at will, more than often, man will identify himself as spiritual or actinic force flowing through the yogic externalities of the outer mind and identify it as a force of life more real and infinitely more permanent than the external mind itself. Occasionally, through his newly exercised extrasensory perception, he may hear the seven sounds he previously studied about in occult lore. The sounds of the atomic structure of his nerve system, his cells, register as voices singing, the veena or sitar, tambura, or as symphonies of music. Instruments to duplicate these sounds for the outer ears were carefully tooled by the rishis of classical yoga thousands of years ago, including the mridanga or tabla and the flute. He will hear the shrill note likened to a nightingale singing, as psychic centers in his cranium burst open, and then an inner voice indicating to his external consciousness, like a breath of air, direction, elucidation. This inner voice remains with him as a permanent yoga of the external, with the internal consciousness an ever-ready guide to the unraveling of complexities of daily life. Occasionally, in a cross-section of the inner mind, when light merges into transcendental form, the young aspirant may view the golden actinic face of a master peering into his, kindly and all-knowing. He is looking at his own great potential. So that's a point that's important to comment on, because it's not generally understood. He's looking at his own great potential. So the context in which I regularly stress this point is, it's in one of my talks about our Paramaguru Yogaswami, and it's the standard talk I give to Yogaswami devotees, when, particularly when we're up in Canada. And it's to balance out the general perception that Yogaswami is way up here on a pedestal, and here we are way down here. And so we're just acknowledging the greatness of Yogaswami. He's great, we're humble, we're trying to be pure and devoted and so forth, and he's great. So that's good, but it's not enough. In other words, we also need to realize that the greatness we see in Yogaswami or any other person is also within us. It's our own spiritual potential. So we never want to just stop and leave someone on a pedestal and ourselves down here. We also want to utilize that insight into their greatness to give us a little more momentum in moving toward our own greatness, shall we say, and look at it that way, that it's our own potential, as Gurudeva says. As the clear white light becomes more of a friend to his external mind than an experience or vision and can be basked in during contemplative periods of the day, the nourishment to the entirety of the nerve system as ambrosia bursts forth from the crown chakra. This is identified inadequately as the peace that passes understanding, for he who reaches this state can never seem to explain it. The highly trained classical yoga adept intensifies, through techniques imparted to him from his guru, the clear white light to the brink of God realization, the void. His entire body is faded into a sea of blue-white light, the Akasha, where now past and future are recorded in the linear depths or layers, sometimes seeing himself seated or standing on a lotus flower of shimmering light in an actinodic, clear, transparent, neon plastic-like body outline as his consciousness touches in tune with a heart's beat into the self, God realization. So it keeps going here, it's kind of deep. But there's a part I wanted to also read. The uninitiated might ask, what is it like to be in the clear white light? The young aspirant may reply, it is as simple as sitting in a darkened room, closing the eyes in deep concentration, and finding the entire inside of the cranium turning into light. At first, it may be only a dim, moon-like glow, a pale flicker of several different colors, but then it becomes as bright and intense as the radiance of the noonday sun, then crystal clear and white. It all depends upon the composition of the mind states of reactionary patterns as to how the light in the cranium will first appear. Of course, clear white light is not absolute, for light invariably implies the existence of shadow. The shadows that sometimes fade out inner light are the instinctive functions that hold the physical body intact. They are represented as attributes in the external mind and character of man. Attachment, for instance, holds ourselves together. It is also the root of much suffering, for attachment to material objects or people keeps man's awareness externalized, incapable of expressing itself in full freedom. Man who is caught in the magnetic forces is prone to resentment. Not being able to cognize various fears as they occur, he stores them up into a conscious resentment of all threats to the false securities found in attachment. Resentment burrows deeply into the outer mind's layers, undermining much of a person's creative endeavor. The reactionary conditions resentment is capable of agitating are subconscious and cast many shadows over clarity of perception for long periods of time. Those who resent are often jealous, another shadow or character weakness which stems from feelings of inferiority, a limited view of one's real self. After one burst of clear white light has occurred, the force fields of attachment, resentment, and jealousy are shattered. An increased control of the mind and expanded consciousness is maintained, which frees man little by little from ever again generating the magnetic holds consuming his consciousness in these shadows. When man allows himself to routine his external thinking and action to settle into uncreative, static conditions, pressures of various sorts build up, and the undisciplined mind releases itself to the emotion of anger, a state of consciousness which renders a man blind to the existence of inner light to any degree. Fear is another shadow which causes man to have an inability to face a critical moment, even in the intimacy of his deepest meditation. But fear is a protective process of the instinctive mind, allowing time to temporarily avoid what must later be faced. Fear, being an intense force in the minds, as well as the body's structure, must be handled positively, for when man thinks under the shadow of fear, he causes his fears to manifest. The flickering shadows of worry brought on by allowing the mind to irrationally jump from one subject to another, never centralizing on any one point long enough to complete it, must be handled through disciplining the flow of thought force, for worry provokes a darker shadow, fear. So that's one of my best favorite explanations of worry. Read that again, because quite often, one point or another, we find ourselves worried about one thing or another. What causes worry? Allowing the mind to irrationally jump from one subject to another, never centralizing on any one point long enough to complete it. So that's what causes worry. We're just allowing the mind to think about something, and without coming to a conclusion, we jump somewhere else. And then without coming to a conclusion about that, we jump somewhere else. Consequently, we're leaving all these loose ends in our thinking. So how do we overcome that? Disciplining the flow of thought force. In other words, we don't allow ourselves to do that. If we're going to think about something, we stick with it and complete the thought. And in completing the thought, then we avoid the worry. Fear, when disturbed, causes anger, submerged anger, resentment, causing a jealous nature. Hence the constant play of the clear white light versus its shadows. By becoming conscious of the way in which the mind operates in even a small degree, the young aspirant to light finds it easy to fold back the shadows into shafts of clear white light. So how do we accomplish all of that? That's where we pull out our shum. Quite often merging with Shiva gives the goal, but it doesn't give you all the details of how to get there. So it's one of the beauties of Gurudeva's language of meditation, the shum language, is that he explains, takes more time to explain the step-by-step process by which we can achieve these experiences. So the basic meditation teachings in the shum language are found in what are called the Mamsani, which are 12 meditation diagrams. And just to make sure we didn't forget them, Gurudeva had them carved into the pillars of Erevan Temple. So they're good for 1,000 years. And at least for the next 1,000 years, we'll all remember the 12 Mamsani. So the January one touches on the subjects we were looking at about the clear white light. So let me read that explanation. Our first Mamsani tells us to not only meditate upon it during vigil, after our worship and before sleep, but all through the day. Yes, we must constantly be looking within ourselves all month during our waking hours. Throughout each day, try to see the light within the mind. Have you ever stopped to think that the light that lights up your thoughts, even when you are in a darkened room, is the light of the mind? That is true. Try taking the image out of the mind, and you will see that only light is left. Just before you go to sleep each night, while you are thinking and visualizing the happenings of the just completed day, the images that you are seeing are set apart, distinguished by light, shadows, and color. This is the light of the mind that you are seeing, but this light is taken for granted. We do not often think about it. We are too involved in the pictures that we are making. The practice to be mastered this month is to consciously remove the pictures and only see the light of the mind, called in shum, balikana. Even in our dreams, there is light which lights up the colors of the scenes that passed before us. Truly, each and every one of us is a divine being of light. Yes, you are a divine being of light, and this you will truly realize by becoming aware of this light within you. Adjust yourself to the realization that you are a divine being, a self-effulgent, radiant being of light. And then the meditation goes into the how-to more, which Gurudeva touched on there. The idea is, and we were practicing this at our recent meditation retreat, that we can see different images in the mind. One of the ones we took was trees, because we were surrounded by trees in our Mill Valley Hillside Retreat Center there. So we were visualizing different trees and then stopping the visualization of the trees and looking at the light that was lighting up the trees. And that's what Gurudeva is calling the moon-like glow. So if you can hold that without any images in it, that's the first experience of inner light. So it's a very simple process, and to make it even easier, it's done with the eyes open. So we're looking inside and outside at the same time. Why is that? because it's easier for the mind not to wander when the eyes are open. When you close your eyes, you can go anywhere. But when you keep your eyes open, the mind doesn't tend to just go off anywhere because it's looking at something outside, so it harnesses it to some degree. So certain meditation exercises, therefore, are done with the eyes open. So this one is done with the eyes open. You're looking out, then looking in and seeing different images, such as the trees, and then you stop seeing images. You say, okay, I don't want any images. And you're looking at the light, which lights up the images. And if the images come back, you quiet the mind down again, and so there's no images there. And then when you can hold that with some continuity, then you can go even deeper into the clear white light, which is much more brilliant. And then if you can hold that, you can go even deeper. You know, there's other exercises that the monks do that take it even further. So, but it's so nicely mapped out in the Shum language. As Gurudeva says in that quote, to take a journey, we need both a means of travel and a destination. Remember I said that one before. So the Shum language gives both. It gives us the destination. We're trying to get into the clear white light. And it gives us a means to get there. In other words, first we do this, then we do this, then we do this, then we do this. And then if all went well, we should be there. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps. Each one a little more subtle than the other. And that's the nature of meditating in the Shum language. It gives you a step-by-step way of getting to a destination, in this case, the clear white light.